you see a door. Above the door is written, MSX Computers. Welcome to the very first episode of the Doors and Dungeons Retro Gaming Podcast. I am your host, Michelle Belmont. So, what you're listening to now is the very first episode of Doors and Dungeons, which I've decided can be called Door Done for short. And I know that sounds kind of stupid, so if everyone ends up hating Door Done, I will totally be open to changing it. There's a little door pun for you. Yes, so... today, in Doors and Dungeons, we're going to be talking about a new retro game for the MSX called Deep Dungeon Adventure. But first, let's get started with a short explanation about the podcast. This podcast is dedicated to classic gaming, and we're going to discuss many games you've hopefully played and loved when you were young. However, I've been living in Japan for about 4 years, so my big goal with this podcast series is to cover a lot of games on Japanese PCs of the 80s and 90s. So maybe you don't know anything about these. Maybe you're an NEC fanatic, or maybe you only know that the PC-98 is that Toho system. But regardless, we're hopefully going to throw tons of good info at you. Since this is the very first episode, I guess it's a good idea for me to tell you a little bit about myself. Again, my name is Michelle Belmont. Yes, I know that sounds like Castlevania. There's a reason for that. It's not what you think, I promise you. But yes, I am an English teacher here in Japan. And I'm also a writer. And I studied theater in college for whatever ridiculous reason I decided to do that. But in the past, I've written for a kind of a startup gaming website that was called FemHype, which was a feminist gaming website. But I eventually left that. I'm not an extremist kind of person who says, you know, we have to do this, 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 and this, and censor this, 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 and this, and all that kind of thing. So for me, it was very difficult to approach my sort of middle-of-the-road way of dealing with these issues when it comes to games. So that's why I actually stopped writing for that website and started writing basically for myself. I've been writing a book, which I'm actually now in the process of doing my edits on and getting to the publisher hopefully this year. So you'll hear more about that as things go on. But this book is basically about my childhood memories of gaming. And one of the reasons I sat down to write it was initially because I read a different book and decided that I could do a better job of writing it. But I also wanted to share a different way of telling stories about games. I think a lot of people tell stories about games either from a purely nostalgic standpoint, and they're never objective, and they just say, this game is great because I played it, and I loved it, and it's great, it's the best game in the world. Maybe in hindsight it's not that good, right? And then there's other people who are solid objective, you know, on this aspect this, and on this part this, and you know, the graphics are, you know, 10 teraflops better than the graphics on the PlayStation version, and you know, the control input has a 10 second more lag on, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I'm not necessarily about that either. So my idea was to sit down and discuss games in a way that is both objective and subjective at the same time. I wanted to bring emotion into the games, but I also wanted to bring sort of a realistic view of it. If a game is bad, I will tell you that it's bad. I will also tell you that I loved it when I was a kid because I didn't know better. But even more important than that, I, as an LGBT person, as a transgender person, had a lot of experiences with games that really hit me in just the right spot. That's every now and then you play a game that allows you to realize something about yourself that you didn't realize before. And you may not notice it at the time, but when you look back, when you start thinking about the games that you've played, sometimes you stumble on that one game and you go, oh, that game meant something to me. That game showed me something. I connected with that character in a certain way. Or I realized that I like this thing about myself or about my life. And those moments are really what define us as gamers, I think, in a lot of ways. And can make a good game great. Or a bad game still memorable. And that's why I decided to write the book, and that's a lot of what I'm hoping to do with this podcast as well. So, as I said, the goal is to cover a lot of different games from classic Japanese PCs, but we're also going to do plenty of stuff from NES and Famicom and Super Nintendo and Game Boy and, you know, other Japanese systems as well, like PC Engine and Sega Saturn maybe, you know. Game Boy Advance, you know, different things like that. I really want to get a full range. But just expect a number of games from Japanese PCs, like the MSX, or the NEC PC 98, or the PC 88. Don't expect a lot of games from the X68000, because I don't currently own a Sharp X68000, because I'm not made of money. I wish I was. And maybe you can donate to my Patreon when I create one, because I'm going to create one soon. And help me get that X68000 so I can talk about it if you ever want to, but it's alright. So, the first system that I ever played was an Intellivision. And it was so cool because I was like 2 or 3 years old, maybe, and I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world. It was like a mystical experience, but then very quickly I realized this was old, and I couldn't deal with that anymore. So eventually, when I was about 6, I got the NES action set with the Zapper and Mario Brothers Duck Hunt, and it was great. But my real pride and joy of gaming as a kid was when I got the Game Boy. I love the Game Boy to death. My mom got it for my birthday, and I think it was kind of hard for her actually to save up the money for it. But once I had it, I was thrilled. Like, I was just elated. And I took it everywhere on so many long car trips that my dad loved to take. I had, you know, so many Game Boy games, and that was really my big focus. So, portable gaming is something you're going to hear a lot of on this podcast. In today's episode of the Doors and Dungeons podcast, we're going to talk about the MSX computer in part one of a two-part series. Part 2 will focus on Deep Dungeon Adventures, a relatively new game for this 35-year-old computer system. To talk about Deep Dungeon Adventure, I have here John Hassink from the Netherlands, who was the sound composer for the game. So, thank you very much. Welcome.
Hello.
Yes. Thanks for having me. Yes. Thank you very much. So, we have you via a webcam mic, so apologies for the audio. It is what it is, but that's okay. And thank you very much for coming on for my first show.
Yeah, well, thanks. It's I'm delighted to be the first one to appear, actually.
I guess the first thing to do would be to actually start out and just kind of explain the MSX a little bit, because, you know, one of my goals with this podcast is to introduce people who have heard the name of some of these Japanese PCs, but don't really know what they're about exactly. Now, I will first clarify that the MSX, there's actually two sort of major lines of MSX. There's the MSX1, or just called MSX, and then the MSX2 series, which is more advanced. And this was made in Japan by a man named Kei Nishi, who worked for Microsoft in Japan, or well, combined, I guess he partnered with Microsoft in Japan. I don't know if he actually worked for them or not. I know he worked for ASCII. Do you know if he worked with Microsoft?
I think it was meant as a joint effort.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of a joint effort, and I think he was sort of somewhat involved. I don't remember if he actually was a direct employee of Microsoft or not. I guess I should have looked that up.
I don't think so, actually, no.
But anyway, he decided to make a computer system that would do something kind of different than other computer systems at the time in Japan. And at that time, computer systems were very kind of wild and crazy because there was no standard at all. Every company had their own operating system, their own sort of version of thing. Even things like BASIC, the programming language, was different between different computers slightly. And it was just, you know, you had to pick who you liked, and you had to buy games made for that system and only that system. And there was, you know, a good 10 or so different major companies, and it was just really chaotic for the consumer. And his goal was to sort of, to try and fix that in a way and create a sort of a standard. So I've got a clip of him talking, which we'll listen to. This is actually from a computer show called Computer Chronicles. And this was in San Francisco. It ran on public television for almost 20 years, from the early 1980s up until like 2002 or something like that, I think. And they covered all kinds of different aspects of computers. But in this episode, they discussed the Japanese computer market. And Kei Nishi was on here talking about why he created the MSX.
The reason why I think MSX is going to have a very important significance among the industry is looking back the history of consumer products. All the consumer products' success is multiple hardware vendor and multiple software vendor. There has been no consumer products that has established only with single source of the vendor. And the beauty of this product is we have a very clear separation of software and hardware.
So you can see he really wanted to create something that multiple companies could get involved in and have in sort of industry standard for Japan. In doing so, and I think even though the MSX itself is not that powerful of a machine, he really did create a standard that a lot of different companies, so like Sony, Panasonic, National, who else made computers for it?
Well, Technics, Korean Daewoo, and what was big in the Netherlands especially, and more or less in Germany, is the company, maybe you heard of them, Philips, from the light bulbs and the CDI, and one of the main developer of the compact disc, actually. Like a really big company in they still exist and they're still pretty big, Philips, and they manufactured and sold MSX machines in the Netherlands, and most Dutch people from my generation actually were most familiar with those models.
Yeah, that's something that I wanted to talk about, was that the MSX then went to Europe. You know, it started in Japan, and there was this idea to try and globalize it, but it never really made it in America at all. I'm not even sure if they introduced it. I'm sure they tried to introduce it, but I don't know, you know, how much. But it was not a thing, really, in America. But it was a big thing in Europe and apparently parts of South America, I believe. Is that correct?
Especially in Brazil.
Yeah.
Because it was affordable, very relatively affordable. And it also had a huge chunk of the market in what we could call the Arabic world, you know, the Middle East, the Gulf states, like Qatar, Iraq, Saudi Arabia. There are actually some Arabic MSX models from Al Alamia. They actually come with an Arabian text font.
Interesting.
There's also even a ROM, official ROM, which contains the Holy Quran. So you can read the Quran on your own. You didn't know that?
No, I did not know that, actually. That's amazing.
Yeah, I know people who own that ROM. My brother owns an Arabian MSX. Actually, there was MSX1 and MSX2. With a dedicated ROM to display Arabic text.
Yeah.
On the screen.
I knew there were some Arabic MSX machines, but I did not know that there was a Quran for it. That's very interesting.
Yeah. It is. It must have been a tremendous work to actually put that.
I can imagine. Nobody took the time to put the Bible onto it, so as far as I know.
No, I don't think that someone did that.
I feel like that would be easier, actually. Or maybe not, considering the keyboard. And that kind of brings me back to the first point, is that it didn't really make it very well in America. I don't think it
Not in America, and also, well, it was also quite big in Russia and the Ukraine, you know, the former Soviet Union countries. It was also very big. We actually got to see in the 80s and the 90s, like music demos and stuff from Russian guys, you know. Actually, I think on the ISS space station, there was an MSX present, and there's video footage of that. It's pretty much functional for education also. That was one of the meanings of the purposes of the system. It was used in Dutch schools as well. You would either find an MSX to teach the pupils, or you would find a Commodore 64.
And that's actually a pretty good way to explain the MSX to someone who has never seen one, is that it's very similar, at least in looks, and I think in some ways the hardware also, to something like the Commodore 64. It's kind of a stand...
Very superficially.
Yeah, superficially, but it's kind of one of those sort of early 80s kind of all-in-one box things with the keyboard and everything, with kind of the angle on it. Most models.
Well, because, of course, the archetypal computer, like the image of a computer that's in most people's minds, I guess, is like a separate box that contains the actual computer.
Well, now it is, yeah.
People are connected to it, but in those days, of course, especially in the 80s, there was like a clear distinction between home computers and personal computers.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that really made the MSX marketable in Japan was the price. Because when you look at what NEC was making, you know, they had business computers. And those business computers were very good for games. But they were business computers, and they cost, you know, roughly, you know, the American equivalent of $3,000, you know, now for one computer.
You mean like the NEC PC 88?
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Was it expensive?
It was very, very expensive at the time in Japan.
Right. Okay, I didn't know this.
Yeah, those PCs were incredibly expensive, and they were, you know, they were like $400 for a floppy drive expensive. So you could get an MSX, and for example, I had just recently sold it. I had a Panasonic MSX2, an A1F. It only cost, I think, about 5 mon, which is roughly $500 of, you know, that time's money, which compared to, you know, to the PC-88 is at least half, you know. So being able to get a computer for half the cost and still play a lot of the big title games and things was a big pull for the home market, but maybe not so much for the business market, which I think is where they perhaps went wrong in terms of marketing it in Japan, because business people had the money.
Yeah, because you want a powerful computer, of course, if you're going to have databases and spreadsheets and stuff.
Yeah, and so let's to explain the basic idea of the system. So we have the MSX1, which I believe is, does that run on a Z80 processor, is that right? I'm not.
Z80?
Yeah.
Z80. Yeah.
We call it Z80 in America. We don't say Z.
Yeah, I'm used to pronounce the Z as Z. It's Dutch, sorry.
Don't worry. It's only America that does that. Everyone else says Z. We're kind of in the minority, actually. Even Japan does that sometimes. Japan will say Z. So it's a very kind of, I wouldn't necessarily say budget, but it essentially is a budget computer. It's a home computer. And it has PSG sound, which you can explain more what that is, but I'm if I remember correctly, that's programmable sound generator, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it was a design actually originally by Texas Instruments, which I think Yamaha manufactured.
Okay.
But the design is American originally, I believe.
And so you have this keyboard, you've got the base unit, you've got the memory, you've got graphics, all of that in one little device, and it has most of your MSX1 machines have a cartridge slot or two cartridge slots, one for normal cartridge software, and then one that's mainly used for add-on devices, and then you've also got a tape port, because back in those days you actually had games on cassette tapes, with data being recorded in analog on cassettes. It was really unreliable, but really cheap to produce.
It must be mind-blowing now, but it's normal, yeah.
Well, a lot of people today don't even remember cassette tapes, even just for listening to music. So the idea that you could take some, little cassette tape for music that you would play in your car and put data on it, I think is really... I'm sure the average listener to this podcast probably knows that it was a thing, but it's probably never seen one or used one. But so you have the input for your cassette, which was a separate device you had to buy. And I think they made like a cable so that you could use kind of normal cassette players and just have this cable to go in between. And then... maybe there were one or two models of the MSX1 that had floppy drives, but not many.
Yeah, that was a bit more rare, I think, yeah.
So that happened, and for a couple years it was kind of popular, and there was a lot of software that was designed for it, mostly games. And then they came out with the MSX2, which increases the amount of memory, but is also compatible with the MSX1.
The biggest difference was probably a better video chip, of course, and usually a bit more memory.
So the MSX2 comes out, and then over time there's slight upgrades to that. So you get the MSX2, which is a standard, and then you get the 2 Plus, which what would you say would be the main new feature of that?
Well, the main feature of the MSX2 Plus was regarded as a slight update of the MSX2 video chip.
Okay, So the video chip was the main thing. And didn't it also try to introduce better scrolling?
Well, it has hardware-supported horizontal scrolling.
Right.
And it has extra screen modes that could display, like what was for that time, an insane amount of colors.
And then, so after that, you get the Turbo R. And this was developed sort of as an afterthought, I think, even after a lot of people had gotten out of the MSX market. Did Philips design that? Is that correct?
No, Philips never manufactured.
They never manufactured one. Oh no, it was only really manufactured in Japan, I believe. Is that right? Yeah. Never came to Europe.
I think actually the only Turbo R machines were manufactured and sold by Panasonic.
Panasonic, that's right, not Philips. Panasonic. Not too many games really took huge advantage of it, I think, but there were some definitely that did. Those are kind of the really expensive kind of rare machines to try and get now. But for most users, if you have a 2 plus and maybe like a memory expansion or an actual modification in the system, you can pretty much do everything that there is to do.
Indeed, you can play, I think, like 95% of all MSX games with an MSX 2 plus perfectly fine. And especially because most MSX 2 Plus models have the FMPEG already.
Right, and that's something we should go into. So sound on these things. So I mentioned that our MSX 1 has the PSG, and MSX 2 also has that PSG.
For that time, it was a pretty advanced chip compared to, like IBM PCs. In that time, they usually onto the advent of the Adlib, of course, they had only one channel speaker.
I know. I used a lot of those when I was a kid. In high school and junior high school, we had PCs with Packard Bell machines with those little beep speakers in them, and it was just one channel, and that was it. So. It's something like PSG is a huge improvement over that, even though it's. Compared to other stuff that was sort of floating around, it was not necessarily as good, but it was way better than what the IBM world was using at the time. So we have this system, and it has PSG, but people think, I want more than that. And when you look at the MSX machines, okay, so your MSX1 has, some of them have a composite video out and an audio out. So then you also have an RF adapter, which you can plug in just like your old NES would be in America. So you can plug it up to your TV or something like that. And these were designed to be used with your TV. There are monitors that are out there that are great for using the MSX. I personally use a NEC PC TV, which is a combination monitor and TV with an RGB input. But... you could plug this up to your little, you know, tiny CRT television. And that was kind of the big draw because you didn't have to spend tons of money on a monitor.
I would like to insert a little side note there. But I remember when I had finally I had my first MSX at home. And it caused a lot of grief for me that some Japanese games, they would force 60 hertz.
Oh, like right.
Like NTSC, and in Europe, we're used to PAL, like 50 hertz. And right. I don't know if you ever seen what happens.
I have. It's
when,
not pretty.
When you force 60 hertz, no. It's a pretty headache-inducing. So.
Yeah.
But I there were many times when I just had a new game, you know, a Japanese game, and I tried it at home, like, yeah, I really want to play this game, and then... the game booted and it forced 60 hertz and the screen went like flipping because you can't play a game like that, of course. So when I got like the Philips monitor which could handle it, but I used to have to hook it up on the TV indeed, which couldn't handle the 60 hertz.
Okay, so I think we've laid out the MSX system pretty well. I guess what I'd like to do next is ask you. Okay, so what is your... I'll say my models of MSX that I've owned, and then I want to know what you've owned. For me, the first model that I had... technically, the first model I had was an emulator. I bought a PC with a S-Video output and got an MSX emulator and plugged it up to a television, and that was how I played MSX for a long time. And until I moved to Japan, I didn't really have access to it. But I eventually found in Japan at a store called Beep in Akihabara, which is a great store. If you ever come to Japan, you should try it out. Tons and tons of retro computers. It's a really great place to see all of what Japan had to offer. Anyway, I bought a Panasonic A1F, which is an MSX2, not a 2+. So one of the big improvements of the MSX2 is that a lot of models had floppy drives, and there was a lot of games that were released on floppy disk, which was way cheaper than ROMs, but a little more reliable than tapes. And so my Panasonic A1F has a floppy drive, which was repaired by the store, Beep, and the whole thing was refurbished. And I used that for a couple years. And then just recently, a few months ago, I found at Beep a quote-unquote broken, they said it was broken, that there was a problem with the keyboard, a Sony Hitbit F500, which is very unique because it's one of the few models that had a detachable keyboard. The main base is designed like a small desktop computer with the two cartridge slots on the front and then a floppy drive on the, you know, beside that, and then you've got just like
some Philips NMS models, actually.
Right. And I love that because I can set a monitor on top of it. I can integrate it in with my other PC systems, and I don't have to have the actual base unit sitting in my lap when I'm playing it, if I want to use keyboard or something like that. So I prefer that much better. So that's what I have now, and for everything else that I've got, it works great. So now, what do you have?
Right now?
Well, I guess what did you start with, and then what do you have now?
What I have now, I only got two machines left. I used to have more, but I sold them or lost them, you know. Now I've got an MSX 2 Plus. It's a Hitbit. It's an HB F1 XDJ.
Easy to remember number, huh?
Yeah, it's a Sony MSX 2 Plus. It's been expanded with extra memory. And I also got on the legendary one-chip MSX.
Oh.
If you remember that.
Yeah, so yeah. That was kind of a later attempt at reviving the system, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So, and I believe it was Kei Nishi, the Japanese creator, he was involved in that, right? Or he was headed up that project, I believe. Is that right?
I don't know if he led the project, but of course, OSCE was involved with it because I think they still own the rights. So you couldn't call it an MSX without their involvement.
I think that I remember reading that he kind of was the one who pushed that to happen. But anyway, so you've got those two. Well, that's really neat. So let's explain a little bit about our sound, because that's kind of important here. So as I said, we have our PSG, but then you've got add-on devices. So you've got FM Pack, which adds a Yamaha FM synthesis chip to it, and also adds some extra save RAM for saving games and stuff.
The FM Pack wasn't the first sound expansion. It was the third, historically, actually.
The FM Pack was the first?
No, the third. The third.
Oh, the third. Oh, wow. Yeah. So what were the other two?
Well, first you got the music module. That's the Philips version. I got one literally next to me right now. But that format, that's nowadays, it's referred to as MSX Audio. And its derivations are MSX Music. So that was the first one, and there's three versions of it. One Toshiba one that didn't have the sample ROM in it. I think only the Philips version does have the sample ROM. And that was actually the first expansion. Second one being Konami's own developed SEC.
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother thing, because those are actually inside the game, which Konami loved doing that, was adding on stuff inside their hardware.
Yeah, like the VRC 6 and 7 for the Nintendo or Famicom, of course.
Yeah, so, yeah. Which So let's pull this back to games that people do know. If you know anything about Castlevania 3 on the NES, It's very different. Well, it's a little bit different in Japan, because in Japan there's an add-on chip called the VRC. I always forget, is it 6 or 7?
That's the VRC 6.
Yeah, okay, 6. And yeah. It adds, I believe it added a little bit of graphical upgrade capabilities, but mainly it added more sound channels. So the Famicom version, the Japanese Famicom version, has a little bit higher quality music than what we got in America, because our American system couldn't read that chip because of the way the American system was designed. There was some component that it couldn't read those add-on chips. So we got a different chip that doesn't really add much in terms of sound, but it still allows it to display properly with the graphics and so on. So the audio is still really good on the NES version, but the Japanese version is even better, and it's got this deepness and sort of...
Awesome.
Yeah, it's like a guitar sound coming from something that's definitely not a guitar. It's really cool.
Well, it's comparable in technique pretty much to the SEC.
Exactly.
It adds some wavetable functionality, like that you could play like the tiny samples, you know.
And unfortunately, Konami decided to make sure that it was only released inside their games, and it could not be used by other companies really.
But it got hacked pretty soon.
Of course. So we've got that, and then we've got Moon Sound, which comes later on, which is a really higher upgraded Yamaha sound chip. So you've got all these different options, okay? And actually, let me ask you, which one do you like working with the best?
Wow. I prefer working on FMPEG and or a combination with PSG or just plain PSG. It remains a really fun challenge. In the early 90s, in the European scene, it was the hype to use what's called MB Stereo, which is a combination of the FMPEG, or, well, I better say it's a combination of MSX music and MSX audio. It's a synergy. How do you say that in English?
Yeah, synergy. That's a good word for it, yeah.
They complete each other because they sound slightly different. And the practice would be to have one, to actually split the sound, to have one chip playing on the left and one chip playing on the right.
Huh.
And I mean like panning-wise.
Yeah.
That's the proper way to do it and how it was meant. And when the Moonblaster program was released, that became a big hype among the scene and homebrew content creators. And that has been like the thing until the Moon Sounds came, like the OPL4. I know people who still love it and love to create music in that format, and I did it, of course, for like the Kai magazine games. But if you'd ask me what I prefer, I just love the FMPEG, especially in combination with PSG. For me, that's next to the SEC. That's the ultimate MSX sound for me.
Once again, I am your host, Michelle Belmont. I hope you enjoyed listening to the Doors and Dungeons Gaming Podcast, and please check out Part 2, where we discuss the charming indie MSX game Deep Dungeon Adventure. If you like the show, feel free to follow it on Twitter, which is @DoorDunPodcast. That's Door, D-U-N, Podcast. See you next dungeon!